It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here as we examine a common way of fixing sewer pipes in our country and the potential effects on human health with noxious fumes. Call in with your questions and concerns about what are called cured-in-place pipe repair projects. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Andrew Welton is a professor of civil engineering and environmental and ecological engineering at Purdue University, studying the risks of these repair techniques. Andrew, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been sounding the alarm bells on this method for over a decade now. We've recently seen a report in USA Today chronicling incidents of people getting sick, including in 2021 at a middle school in Spooner, Wisconsin. Can you explain how cured-in-place pipelining works?
Absolutely. It's an innovative technology where pipes that are buried beneath the ground are fixed in place without having to dig them up and shut down roads. But one of the issues, which is really central to the technology, is that you soak a sock in resin or raw chemical, you slide it into the pipe, and then you cook it. The problem is the waste is not captured. It's often just blown directly into environment and into nearby buildings, which is what happened, I believe, in Spooner, Wisconsin.
And so you say this is innovative, but hasn't it been around, this technique, for decades?
It has. It came in the 1970s into the U.S., but once a patent expired for a company called Insigiform Technologies, a lot of different companies started forming to do this technique as well. And so as the infrastructure needs repaired, this is a relatively inexpensive, quick process that a lot of people see an opportunity to make money from.
Is the resin formula, the resin recipe, if you will, is that standardized? Or are there a lot of different types of ways that you can cure pipes with different various resin recipes?
So that's a great question. Initially, when we started getting involved 10 years ago, the industry said that there's really only one or two different types of resins. But it turns out there's been over 20 different types of resins used, and each of them have different chemistries or different chemicals in them. When you cook the resins and you transform them from a liquid to a plastic, a hard plastic, you can either use UV light, steam, hot water, or you can just let it cook itself in the ambient air.
And so when we see steam rising up from a sewer hole, you can that suggests that this technique is being used.
Well, I would first caution you and all your listeners that what's coming out of the sewer hole isn't steam when this technology is used. We figured that out in 2017. That is nothing like a shower that you would, you know, take a steam shower in. That is raw liquid droplets of pure chemical, particulates, wax, microplastics, and nanoplastics coming out. So I would avoid going near that waste emission.
Why is this technique risky for human health? What is in that concoction of organic compounds that is hurting human health?
Well, it turns out that many of the workers and even the company owners that bought the technology didn't really understand what types of chemicals that they were handling and discharging into the environment and nearby buildings. The chemicals that have gotten the most discussion are styrene, which is a probable carcinogen. It can be acutely toxic if you're exposed to it, especially for children and immunocompromised people. But there's a whole host of other chemicals in that emission, such as methylene chloride, sometimes benzene, sometimes other chemicals, which are known to cause, you know, immediate health impacts.
We're talking about the risks with a commonly used form of pipe repair with Andrew Welton, professor and director of the Healthy Plumbing Consortium at Purdue University. You can join in with your questions, your comments on this type of cured-in-place pipe lining, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Andrew, explain the upsides here, the advantages for this type of pipe repair. I would imagine it's way more cost-effective than digging up a pipe and replacing it.
Absolutely. So this technology can be about 80% less expensive than digging up a pipe. And so when officials are challenged with a limited budget and they can replace 80 miles of pipe or 20 miles of pipe, they'd prefer the 80 miles. The challenge here is just the waste emission. And there are ways to capture or just minimize the amount of waste you're producing. But right now, the cheapest approach for using this technology, which is what everybody generally pursues, is the one where the waste is blown into the environment in nearby buildings.
In 2017, you said this method is used in about half of pipe repairs in our country. Is that statistic still holding up?
I think it's probably used in potentially every county across the country. We've seen ebbs and flows with regards to how popular it is. But I would say that, yes, it is the most common pipe repair placement technology in the United States.
And then the other option, though, is to just dig up and replace the pipe and repair it that way? Or are there other ways that you can do this?
So the excavation approach, where you dig up a broken pipe and you install a new pipe, is what is often compared against for CIPP technology. And that is costly, that shuts down roadways, people are out of sewer or water service for days, sometimes weeks. There are other technologies that you can use. There's one called slip lining, where you slide a smaller plastic pipe that's already formed inside the existing pipe. And there's another technologies as well, but CIPP is the least expensive, generally fastest way to repair pipes in place.
You know, I'm thinking about that there are poisonous lead pipes. There are lead laterals that are being replaced in cities all around the country, including here in Wisconsin. Is this method used for that type of repair?
It actually is. Less than 1%, though, of all drinking water pipes are being replaced using CIPP. And that's primarily because many of the approaches or pilot projects weren't successful. And so the industry is trying to figure out how to successfully use this on a larger scale for drinking water pipes, but it really hasn't caught on yet.
I would be really concerned to ensure that the testing is there, because I'd be worried about leaching from the resin over time.
And that's a valid concern. One way that industry approaches leaching from plastics is that they pay a third party that conducts leaching testing on their products. One of the challenges, however, with the transformation of our pipes from metal to plastic when it comes to drinking water is that many of the chemicals that leach out of these plastics are not on the list of things that you actually look for. And so we need to put a little more effort into understanding what's happening as we transition from metal to plastic world.
Purdue University civil engineering professor Andrew Welton researching the effects of cured-in-place pipelining projects. Call in with your questions, your concerns about this approach to pipe repair. What have you have learned about it? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn what's in chemical plumes rising from sewer hole covers when repairs are underway using the cured-in-place pipe repair method. Call in with questions and thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Andrew Welton is a professor of civil engineering and environmental and ecological engineering at Purdue University. Andrew, the National Association of Sewer Service Companies, they've pushed back on your findings about cured-in-place piping, and they denounced your peer-reviewed study you led in 2017 that found it puts pollutants in the air, as we've been talking about. And the group later led a study that says your results were non-conclusive. How have these companies responded in years since?
So back in 2017, when we discovered that the emissions coming out of these manholes were not steam, we talked to many CIPP company owners and members of this organization called NASCO, and they were not aware that the materials posed an acute health risk and even long-term health risk to their own workers. Some of these workers were family members that worked for their companies that had been in these manholes and such. So there was a lot of concern and anxiety within these agencies and organizations, and that prompted organizations to lash out and put a whole bunch of misinformation out there into the industry, into the public space, which I attribute a lot of this to.
Have you responded with more research? What has been your pushback here?
Well, we are not pushing back. Because there's nothing to push back against. We were funded by the National Science Foundation, NSF.gov, the National Institutes of Health, Environmental Sciences, the Federal Highway Administration, the US EPA. Over the years, we have just been working to get answers for workers and the public and health officials to understand what to do about it and what the consequences are of exposure.
What regulatory body should be addressing these emissions?
So from a worker safety standpoint, OSHA is responsible, and even state OSHA agencies are responsible. Many of these agencies were not aware that this process was taking place in their states and in the country, and so they're trying to get up to speed. In the general public space, you know, children, people in their homes and schools, that is the US EPA's responsibility to regulate and oversee the protection of public health when it comes to chemicals and air. And then states are also responsible for protecting their own citizens against chemical exposures due to ambient air or indoor air. And many of these agencies were simply unaware that this was happening.
Have any of these agencies taken a lead on this or made it a priority?
So actually, last year, the Washington, D.C. Department of Energy and the Environment, or DOEE, which is a local air quality regulator for where people live in Washington, D.C., legally compelled a water utility to conduct air testing during their CIPP projects. And that is, to my knowledge, the first time this has ever happened. That was done so out of concern that the water utility and the CIPP contractors couldn't accurately explain to the regulator what exactly the risks were associated with their technology.
Did they publish those findings?
That's ongoing, but one of the challenges is that the utility hired an industry-focused research team that had previously put out information that was inaccurate. So there's concern that it's potentially that there's no independence associated with that study.
You bring up the safety and harm of workers in doing this cured-in-place piping process. Are you aware of any class action lawsuits?
I am not aware of any class action lawsuits associated with this. Generally, what we've seen is workers settle with their companies and then sign non-disclosure agreements. And I know that firsthand because workers have called me right before they settled and told me some things.
Let's go to Tamara in Ashland. Hi, Tamara. What is your question?
Hello there. I'm wondering how cities get to choose who works on these pipelines. I was at my residence with my grandson and my son, and we have asthma. and suddenly we couldn't breathe and we're very sick. And outside our house, somebody was working on the sewer pipe. And they were not attending it was like this trailer over the sewer pipe, and the steam was bellowing everywhere. And my grandson and my son and I had to leave the area because we felt sick. And, you know, Ashland decided this was the best way to approach this. And I'm wondering what I can do, you know, to influence that decision making, or how to protect myself when they're doing this work.
Tamara, thank you for bringing that personal story. Andrew.
So, Tamara, I'm sorry that that happened to you and your family. It shouldn't have happened. The way that you can protect yourself, first of all, is having a utility that's responsible, that recognizes the risk that the plastic manufacturing waste poses to its people. So there are ways that you can specify in the contracts that the waste is captured or certain technologies are avoided, and certain resins are avoided. As far as using that technology, if it's used, you'll often hear contractors say, pour water in your plumbing traps, but that doesn't always work because the emissions can waft across your property, through your windows, cracks and doors, and such like that. So really what we recommend people to do is evacuate their building if they are very concerned about it, especially if they have immunocompromised populations. And then also if there are any health impacts and such, contractors and utilities like you to go to them to contain the information. And the fact of the matter is neither of them have medical training. And so you really should go to a public health official or a medical doctor for medical and exposure advice, not the people who just want to fix a pipe and kind of move on.
Andrew Welton with us, a professor and director of the Healthy Plumbing Consortium at Purdue University, as we explore the cured in place pipelining process. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. You know, Tamara mentions trying to understand or get at the root of this before it actually happens and it's outside your door and happening. You know, President Biden has this infrastructure law, historic infrastructure law, supposed to provide funds to rehab and replace aging infrastructure. How can communities be sure their sewer lines are updated safely when the money is there?
So the new infrastructure money coming down from the federal government to different states will undoubtedly increase the number of CIPP projects in communities nationwide. And the way that that can be positively influenced to protect people from harm so that their pipes can be fixed in an economical way is that state agencies that are responsible for handing out that money require that these municipalities have certain controls in place if they use CIPP technology. So municipalities have to go to the state to obtain low interest loans. And as part of that, you can insert conditions that require certain actions in those loan applications. That's one way that the state can better protect people across Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country.
Turning to how to keep yourself safe, you mentioned evacuate. For how long? How is there any knowledge of how long these chemicals stay in the air?
So generally, people say that the chemicals stay in the air for hours to a couple days if they do enter and there's no way for the chemicals to get out. We have encountered several situations where contractors leached out actually raw resin inside the sewer line, which didn't cook, and therefore it simply off-gassed and vapors went up for months, people's sewer laterals. So there's a number of different situations where you may have just a couple hours the chemical exposures occur, or it could occur longer. That's why people need to engage their health officials, their public health officials, because those people can advocate on their behalf.
So if that pipe doesn't cure or cook properly, does that mean they have to redo the process, or how do you fix that?
Well, that's a great question. Sometimes contractors come back and just run water down it to try to flush out the uncooked resin. Sometimes there's another pass at the cooking process. And sometimes they'll go in and they'll cut a hole in the pipe to kind of suck out any uncooked resin and then patch it and fix it.
Andrew, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Andrew Welton is a professor of civil engineering and environmental and ecological engineering at Purdue University. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Over 9,000 clinical trials are underway in Wisconsin. That's from medical research industry analyst CenterWatch. It says across the country, hundreds of thousands of volunteers each year step up to participate in medical research. Call in with your questions about how clinical trials work, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Betsy Nugent is Director of Clinical Trials Development and Accreditation and Chief Clinical Research Officer at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and UW Health. Betsy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, put this in perspective for us. Why are clinical trials so important to the advancement of medical science and treatments?
Yeah, well, clinical trials are really the only way that new drugs and treatments and devices are approved. And they also are the way that we study different ways to use standard or already approved treatments and drugs so that they'll be more effective and easier to use and decrease side effects. And also, it helps us to understand how to safely use a treatment in a new population. So, for example, if a drug's approved in adults, they help us figure out how to use that same treatment in children if we can.
And this is a very active space for research institutions. How are enough volunteers found to meet the needs of medical researchers?
You know, that's really challenging, and it's so critically important that we have people participate in clinical trials, because obviously if we don't have enough folks participating, it makes it really hard to approve new drugs and treatments. So a lot of people participate maybe because they have a disease. So for example, in cancer research, a lot of volunteers are folks that have a certain cancer, a certain condition for which they're seeking treatment, and they may, with their provider, select a clinical trial as one of their treatment options. So that's one way that people can participate in clinical trials. Another way is that sometimes individuals may be at risk, their family may be at risk, their community may be at risk, and while they may be healthy, they may want to volunteer in future discovery and future innovation in that area, really to contribute to the community and to society. So those are just a couple ways. We also sometimes need healthy volunteers. And oftentimes people will participate as a healthy volunteer, again, for altruistic reasons to help the community and society at large.
These clinical studies in our day and age, they're becoming larger, they're taking longer. We're seeing ads for them on TV to recruit people. How do you retain people in these clinical trials?
That's a really great question. So in the clinical trials, oftentimes folks, particularly that may have a disease, really end up getting some extra attention and extra care. They often have more frequent visits for safety reasons. We may be calling them and keeping in touch with them more frequently just to make sure that they're safe and we're understanding what the new drug or treatment may be doing. And so there's a lot of partnership between participants and researchers in clinical trials, and that's how we really try to retain individuals. We also try to really be patient-centric because we know it's a huge ask to have folks participate in a clinical trial. And so it's really important that we keep the patients at the center or the participants at the center of what we're doing.
And I would imagine there could be transportation barriers. There could be language barriers, other things that keep someone either away from the trial or not completing it. How do you navigate around those things and make sure that your trials are diverse?
Yeah, that's a really, really important point because the FDA has really stepped up to say that they're going to require more diversity in clinical trials. And that's extremely important because each person is unique and their experience, life experience, their experience with the disease may be different. And so we want all communities and people to benefit from medical advances. So we need to rethink the way that we do clinical trials. And some of this already occurred during COVID-19 because people obviously couldn't leave their homes, couldn't travel for clinical trials. And so we had to be creative about using technology and other ways to get in touch with people and to provide them access to clinical trials. But I think it goes further than that. We need to make sure that we really understand what the barriers to participating in a clinical trial are. You know, if we do clinical trials just 8 to 5, that's a huge barrier for people that have a job where they can't take time off. And sometimes clinical trial visits can be a couple hours long. And so that's a real burden. So having extended hours, being able to see patients on the weekend, being able to provide transportation, which is something we've done at UW for a while, providing vouchers for things like cabs or Uber or bus rides to get folks to the facilities where we're doing clinical trials, but also bringing clinical trials to more facilities. Traditionally, they've been done at academic medical centers, but can we do them in a clinical setting? Can we do them in community centers? And just being really innovative about the way we think about bringing clinical trials to our community.
To what extent is mistrust of the medical establishment a barrier? We've heard historic abuses like the Tuskegee syphilis study. How much of an impact does that have on clinical trials and increasing diversity?
It does still have a big impact, to be honest. I think, you know, there is historic distrust between many groups of people and researchers, and probably well earned at the, you know, from history. But I think it's really incumbent on researchers like myself, like those investigators that I work with, to get out in the community and start talking and answering questions and making sure that individuals feel like we are moving forward and we want to do the right thing, because ultimately clinical trials move medicine forward for everyone. And so we want everyone to be included.
We're talking about clinical trials with Betsy Nugent, Chief Clinical Research Officer at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in with your questions, your experiences in medical research, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We heard from Jeff in Appleton, who was wondering, how many drugs make it to trial, and then how many get approved? Does paying for these trials make the pharmaceutical medications cost more, Jeff asks.
Yeah, so it's a long process for a drug to get all the way through all the clinical trials and get approved by the FDA. I think the average is between something like 10 and 7% of drugs that enter clinical trials actually make it to market. And that could be for a number of reasons. It may not be tolerated well. There may be side effects that are unacceptable to patients. The dosing regimen may be too difficult. So there is a very small number. And clinical trials can be quite expensive. One of the things that is going on right now is there's a real push to not only make clinical trials more expedited by, you know, trying to find efficiencies in paperwork and some of those kinds of things, but not sacrificing safety of our participants and patients. So there is a lot of activity going on in that area, but you're right. Clinical trials are an expensive endeavor. And, you know, I'm not sure that that necessarily adds to the cost of drug, but I'm sure the research and development certainly does at some point. And so, you know, the process is really meant to get safe drugs to market. And so I do think that comes with a cost, but some of the costs, particularly of oncology drugs, can be quite prohibitive. So the government is really working with research institutions and pharmaceutical companies to try and bring those costs down.
Turning to children, there are clinical trials for pediatric medication and treatments. How is enrolling children in clinical trials handled?
Yeah, so in clinical trials with children, it tends to be children that have a disease. So unfortunately, there's many diseases in children that are very serious. And so clinical trials can be a great option for those patients. And the informed consent is done by the parents, although the child often will give assent to participate in the trial. And those, you know, are typically rare diseases in children. And so we will have a small number of children participating, but oftentimes with hopefully positive outcomes that allow them to live a long and healthy life. At UW, we had children actually participate in some of the COVID vaccine trials,
yes.
And they were some of the bravest participants we ever had and very altruistic. Many times when we talked to the children, they said they weren't doing it for themselves, that they were doing it so other kids wouldn't be infected with COVID-19. And so, you know, pediatric clinical trials can be very powerful, but we do try and bring them, particularly when there are rare childhood diseases that result in a lot of morbidity and a lot of mortality.
Betsy Nugent, Chief Clinical Research Officer at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and UW Health, our guide to clinical trials. Call in with your questions and comments about clinical trials, how they work, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with the leader of clinical trial research at UW School of Medicine and Public Health and UW Health. Betsy Nugent is here as thousands of clinical trials are actively recruiting in Wisconsin. Call in with your questions about clinical trials, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Betsy, UW Carbone Cancer Center, one of three American research facilities taking part in this breast cancer vaccine clinical trial, and Carbone was the first to administer the vaccine to a patient, a participating patient. What is the potential significance here?
Yeah, I think this is really a new area of research that's really exciting, and so this particular trial is for women that have already had triple negative breast cancer and hopes to prevent a recurrence because in that particular cancer, recurrence is common. And so this is a whole new area where the vaccine actually sort of revs up the immune system to fight the cancer itself. And so it's really exciting, and UW is very excited to be the first site to administer the vaccine to one of our patients. And I think this is a whole new area that's going to open up, that's going to be really important, particularly for patients that have had cancer. But hopefully, we would love to get to a point where, you know, we have more precision medicine around all kinds of things like cancer, and like we do for infectious diseases, where we can do some prevention. And so I think this is a really, really exciting and important area.
And I think it serves the point to bring up that there are trials ongoing for every stage of cancer. And this being for an early cancer, my guess is early cancer phase one, perhaps. But what should we know about, you know, about these different phases of cancer, and that treatments can focus on any type of phase?
Yeah, so you know, there are lots of different types of treatments that are underway for cancer. And I'm not a clinician myself, but certainly we always encourage our patients who are being seen in oncology to have discussions with their providers. You know, one of the things I think that's really important is we're trying to advance technology to make sure that clinical trials are the range of clinical trials available to the patient are also in front of the provider at the time they're making treatment decisions. And this is an area that's going to be really important, because oftentimes in cancer, a clinical trial may be one of the treatment options for the patient, or sometimes it really could be the best treatment option if there aren't a lot of options. And so depending on what stage of cancer the patient's in, whether they have, you know, failed their first line therapy and are going on second line therapy, the importance of really having the opportunity to look at clinical trials at those time points is really critical, particularly for oncology patients. And so we're doing a lot of work on figuring out how is the best way to make sure that information, because there are literally hundreds of trials in many different areas of cancer, are in front of the patient at the time they need to make some decisions. And so that's where really technology and this whole area of clinical trials can come together to help patients and their providers make good decisions.
Right, because how do you find a trial that is right for you and right for your cancer?
Exactly. And so there are patients that might want to do some exploring on trials, or family members that might want to explore. There's a lot of different places you can go. One is the Center for Information and Study on Clinical Research Participation. They can help to find trials. Also, clinicaltrials.gov is the government registry of all clinical trials that are going on. CenterWatch also has one. But one thing I will advise is that oftentimes the name of a trial can be very complex. It includes a lot of scientific and medical terms. And so sometimes disease advocacy groups like the American Cancer Society or the American Diabetes Society can be really helpful in helping individual patients find a clinical trial that might be right for them and figure out what facility that clinical trial is running at.
Betsy Nugent with us, Chief Clinical Research Officer at UW School of Medicine and Public Health and UW Health. Let's take a call. Nancy is joining us from Milwaukee. Nancy, hi. What would you like to ask?
It is my understanding that a person cannot participate in any kind of drug study if you're already taking a drug of any kind. Some years ago, I wanted to participate in a drug study for blood pressure medication, but I was taking a statin, a very 20 milligram statin pill, and I could not participate in this study for blood pressure. And my feeling is that many older people are never going to be able to ever participate in a study, because many older people are on one or more kinds of drugs, and therefore you're never testing older people for the very drugs that they need.
Nancy, thank you for bringing this. Betsy.
Yeah, Nancy, that's a great point. And, you know, I think many older people are excluded because they may be taking other drugs. Part of the reason that that happens is there in clinical trials, there are really strict eligibility criteria. And so they don't oftentimes want drugs that they think might interact with the drug that they're testing. And that's why they're excluded. But in later stage clinical trials and something called phase four, which is after the drug is marketed and approved by the FDA, sometimes in those trials, they really want real world evidence because, like you say, Nancy, in the real world, you know, people that are older often aren't taking no drugs. They're often taking quite a lot of medications and supplements and things like that. And so we do need real world data. And there are clinical trials for those as well. And so just because you might have been excluded for this particular one because maybe the statin was made you ineligible, in many clinical trials, you can be taking other drugs just as long as they aren't suspected to interact with the drug that's under study.
Nancy, thank you for that call. I want to turn to COVID vaccines here for a moment and just the lessons learned as you looked at the medical research and pharma and government all coming together. How has, though, the mix of public acceptance and skepticism for vaccines affected clinical trials for vaccines that could treat other diseases?
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, you know, clinical trials like the ones we saw for the vaccines and the ones that UW and UW Health did during the early days of the pandemic don't come around that often. There aren't that many clinical trials that come around that really are for the entire population, but certainly this happened during COVID-19. And even though in the news we saw a lot of potential negativity towards the vaccine, we actually found at the University of Wisconsin and UW Health that people really embraced the opportunity to participate and do something during COVID-19 to help other people. And so our clinical trials actually got filled immediately for vaccine opportunities, both for adults and for children. And so we had a waiting list that unfortunately we couldn't get everyone into the trials. But really, people came forward and were part of the trials, not only for themselves, but many times to protect loved ones, to protect people that they worked with, to protect people in the community. And so that was really amazing to see all the altruism and all the support that came forward for clinical trials in those early days of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Betsy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really wonderful.
Betsy Nugent is Director of Clinical Trials Development and Accreditation and Chief Clinical Research Officer for the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and UW Health. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back.